Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. Insurgents firing at least one mortar shell briefly took over the center of the western Iraqi town of Ramadi today. One of the goals of the attacks was to stop a meeting between U.S. Marines and anti-U.S. Iraqi tribal leaders, both groups trying to reach an agreement on withdrawing U.S. troops from the region. The historic talks take place as the U.S. kicks off a second joint Iraqi-U.S. operation in the area to clear out insurgents. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Ellen Nickmeyer of The Washington Post. And Ellen, you were at the first of these two groundbreaking meetings. It was held on Monday. Both sides said they wanted withdrawal, but can you just first tell us, what was it like to be there?
You felt like you were kind of in the heart of Anbar's situation. I mean, you were with the tribal leaders who at least support the resistance, who they oppose the U.S. occupation, U.S. military presence very strongly, and they want the U.S. troops out of there. And the two sides, they were at cross purposes at times in kind of a really fascinating way.
But many of the officers told you that they thought it was going well, that the tribal leaders had even shown up.
That's true. It was, even though they had different aims at times. I mean, both sides left thinking they had accomplished something, right. And maybe they did. I mean, they agreed to a follow-up meeting on Thursday, and they did open dialogue. Just opening dialogue can be a step forward.
Well, and as you write, mortar shells were, you know, hitting the walls during that meeting on Monday, and I think you wrote of one U.S. officer who said to the tribal leaders, it's good, we're not flinching.
That's right. The Marines said that showed, even though they had all the tribal leaders here in the meeting hall, there were still plenty of people who wanted to stop that dialogue.
At that meeting on Monday, you said that Americans asked the tribal leaders to encourage young men to join the Iraqi military so that Iraq could have its own military and the U.S. could leave. What was the response to that?
The Sheikhs, they're very suspicious of troops from the rest of the country coming in, of Shias or Kurds coming in, and they were asking for an Anbar division in the National Army.
Right. There were also some remarks that, in fact, perhaps Iran would be a bigger enemy ultimately than the U.S. Coalition.
That's right. It was interesting to me that the one point in the meeting that got applause was when one of the sheikhs said, you know, the Americans will leave today and then we're going to have to worry about Iran.
Well, Ellen Nickmeyer, you were in this meeting on Monday. Another meeting was held today and the town was overrun by insurgents briefly. What impact do you think that's going to have?
I should say that there's vastly differing reports on what happened this morning. We've had the governor's office confirm that reports from citizens and residents and others that hundreds of armed men, a couple hundred armed men, were in the streets of Ramadi for about 3 or 4 hours this morning while there were no Marines present, and that they set up at checkpoints and took one small city building and that they executed one official. And the Marines say they know of absolutely no unusual activity in Ramadi this morning. So that's kind of the disparity in accounts that we're getting right now. And we're told, last report I heard was the meeting had managed to go on, but there were fewer tribal leaders previously.
Ellen, how important is this meeting between tribal leaders and U.S. officials, and how important is it that the tribal leaders come along?
This meeting could be something that goes nowhere, or it could be an instance of Sunnis and American military officials seeing that they have common interests in curbing some of the violence and moving forward and trying to bring peace back to their region.
Given that it could be such an important first step, how nerve-wracking was it for you, apparently, to realize, I guess through your interpreter, that some of the remarks were really poorly translated in this meeting? For instance, at one point, a U.S. officer said, we're here to work through the problems. There are no easy solutions. And the translation was, I don't have any time to waste.
Right. That was surprising to us, if not shocking to us, to watch. And the main problem is that, you know, you're in a country where the Americans just can't speak to the people who they're dealing with, and there's a shortage of good translators, and I haven't before seen it be a problem. I don't think it greatly impacted on the results of the meeting, but there were tones and results that I don't think the Americans intended.
Ellen Nickmeyer, Baghdad bureau chief of the Washington Post. Earlier this week, she attended a meeting between U.S. officials and tribal leaders in Ramadi in western Iraq. Ellen, thank you.
You're welcome.
Today, researchers from the New England Journal of Medicine give details in the deaths of four women who died after taking the abortion drug RU486. The Food and Drug Administration has issued warnings about the drug, including that it has been found that all the women who took it died from a common bacteria, and the agency plans to investigate their deaths early next year. We'll speak to a doctor who contributed to the New England Journal report in a moment, but first, Monty Patterson's daughter Holly took RU486 in 2003 and died a week later. He says the drug is to blame, and he's suing the makers and a nonprofit, non-governmental agency called the Population Council, which developed the pill in the U.S. and held clinical trials in Canada. And Monty Patterson now joins us from California. Monty, first, we are sorry for your loss.
Well, thanks, Jess. It's been a hard time for the family, and it just still seems like yesterday, even though it has been a little over 2 years now.
Right. Well, when this all happened, were you even familiar with the pill RU486, and did you know that Holly had taken it?
No, I was not familiar with RU486. I didn't even know that an abortion pill existed, and I hadn't been aware that Holly was seeking a medical abortion, and I hadn't been informed by her, and it was really at the hospital when I first found out on the day that she died.
Yeah, it must have been stunning because she died quickly from a bacterial infection. And before that, what did she tell you? What did she tell you about needing to go to the hospital?
You know, Holly had covered it up pretty well by telling me that she was having severe cramps and in a very bad period. So, you know, it was her and her boyfriend had really had done a good job of just sort of assuring me that everything was going to be okay and that they were just going to get checked out.
When she first went to the hospital with this, you know, what she said was a bad period, she was given painkillers and sent home?
That's correct. She went to the emergency room and told the emergency room doctors what her problem was, that she was in severe pain, abdominal pain.
Did she tell them, by the way, that she had taken RU486?
Yes. She was fully upfront with the doctors about what she had done as far as going to Planned Parenthood and being administered RU-46 or mifepristone, and that she was in a lot of pain. So they basically gave her some painkillers and a shot of Demerol and sent her back home.
And then obviously she had to return to the hospital when the pain became too acute and did die. Did doctors tell you why she died?
Well, basically explained to me is that they said it was a result of complications from taking the abortion pill and that she had developed sepsis and eventually septic shock.
RU-486 is actually part of a regimen in which women take the pill in conjunction with misoprostol. We're going to learn more about the procedure from a doctor in a moment. But you, after Holly's death, began to research the use of this regimen. What did you find about its fatality rate?
Well, one of the things that I found out that was very disturbing to me is that anywhere from 1 to 10% of all adverse events are ever reported to the FDA or to the manufacturer. So, you know, there was a real problem there right to begin with that we really weren't sure how many women may have died or how many women have been suffering needlessly as a result of taking this drug.
But you did find that there were other women who had died.
Well, I found through doing a lot of research with my wife Helen, who is Holly's stepmother, that a woman in Canada had died in September of 2001 from the exact same bacteria that Holly died from.
What did you do after you found out that a woman in Canada had died from RU-486?
Well, first of all, my wife and I had gone to Washington to meet with the White House and the FDA to express our concerns that another woman in Canada had died of medical abortion during a clinical trials, and that she had this bacteria Clostridium sordelli. We wanted to bring it to their attention, and we also wanted to let them know that we felt that this drug impaired the immune response, which predisposes women to these infections.
Well, again, we're going to ask a doctor about that and other opinions, but Monty, you ultimately found that other women died.
Well, after Holly died in December of 2003, a young Vietnamese woman in Southern California died. And then in January, an African-American woman, she died And then in June of this year, a 34-year-old mother with two children died also, and consequently it was all due to the same regimen, same drug, same procedure, and also the same bacteria.
Well, and we should say Danko Laboratories defends RU-486. They say all abortion procedures involve risks. And the drug has been used by millions of women in Europe and Asia with no deaths reported. They say that that's a good safety record.
Well, for one thing, we're not comparing apples to apples here. In Europe, there are different procedures, the way they administer the drug and how patients are looked over, watched after, particularly in France. They're in the hospital. They have a different administration of the drug. But again, I would still challenge that reporting is a problem, mainly because I think that what we're finding out now, doctors have failed to make the connection between this infection and the drug.
We should make clear that you said that this regimen is administered differently in other countries. We mentioned that RU-486 is taken in conjunction with misoprostol. Here in the U.S., misoprostol, the second part of the regimen, is administered vaginally. In other countries, it's taken orally in the doctor's office. Do you think it's the misoprostol that's causing the problem or the RU-486, the pill?
I feel without a doubt that it's RU-486, and other doctors are also confirming that with their own research.
And we're going to hear from a doctor in a moment, but it really just doesn't make sense that there just haven't been any reports of deaths with millions of women taking RU-486.
We haven't heard about them yet. These are the type of things that the public doesn't hear about.
Now, Monty, you've said you want people to be able to make informed decisions. Do you want to see RU-486 pulled from the market?
Yes, I do, because what I know now about this drug, this is about the health, safety, and welfare of women. And knowing that this drug has very serious health consequences, I couldn't consciously sit here and tell you that I think this drug is safe, especially after me watching my daughter die and in such a tragic and a horrible death.
Before this happened to your daughter, Holly, would you have said that you were in a pro-choice, pro-life camp? Did you have opinions about abortion?
I did not have opinions about abortion. I had opinions about my daughter. I would say that I was pro-Holly.
Monty Patterson, he's speaking to us from Livermore, California. His 18-year-old daughter, Holly, took the abortion pill RU-486 in 2003 and died a week later from an infection that Monty feels was caused by the pill. He's now suing the makers. Monty, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And just ahead, today's New England Journal of Medicine editorial concludes that fears over RU-486 are overblown. Well, we'll hear from the doctor who wrote that editorial. Also later in the program, this note, music after the flood, sounds from New Orleans. Much more coming up here and now. Here and now, and we've been talking about the abortion-inducing pill RU-486, not by the way the contraceptive, the morning-after pill, but the only form of medical abortion. We spoke with Monty Patterson. His daughter died after taking RU-486, and he's now suing the manufacturer, saying patients should have known that the pill had caused a death in clinical trials in Canada. Well, we're now joined by Dr. Michael Green, chief of obstetrics at Massachusetts General Hospital here in Boston. He's also worked with the Federal Centers for Disease Control to try to identify the bacteria that killed women who died after taking RU-486. And he's written an editorial in today's issue of the New England Journal of Medicine about the risks associated with the drug. And, Doctor, you reviewed Holly Patterson's medical records. So, first of all, did she die of this bacteria?
It sure does look like she died of this infection due to an organism named Clostridium sordellii. This is a relatively unusual infection in the circumstances of OBGYN events, but it is not totally unknown, but it can be, as was for her and the other three women that died in California. It was fatal.
Do we know how Holly and those other women picked up that bacteria?
We don't know. We do know that Clostridium sordellii, as well as lots of other bacteria, are very commonly found in the rectum and the genital tract of women. Most of the time, these bacteria sort of hang around and don't cause any trouble, don't cause any mischief. But why, under these circumstances, for these five women, including one woman in Canada, this organism caused lethal infections, we don't know.
Monty Patterson says researchers have found that RU46 lowers a person's immune response, and that's why they become vulnerable to bacteria. Is there fact there?
I'm not aware that there is a good evidence that that's true. I remain to be convinced of that. If that were true, again, there's no reason why they wouldn't see the same kinds of problems in Europe and China. And I've spoken with colleagues in both Europe and China, and they assure me they haven't seen these kinds of problems.
Well, and as we said, this medical abortion procedure is a regimen. It's mifepristone, or RU486, which is taken by tablet, in conjunction with misoprostol, which is taken orally, we understand, in other countries, but vaginally in the U.S. and often without a doctor's supervision. Is that the possible culprit, the misoprostol and not the RU486?
We don't know. That's a reasonable hypothesis, but we don't know. It's used intravaginally in the United States because it's associated with less symptoms of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and sort of other unpleasant GI side effects. But whether that's the reason that we've seen these deaths, nobody really knows for sure.
Well, as you well know, millions of women have taken this drug abroad, and no deaths have been reported. Now, Monty Patterson thinks that that's because there is a reporting problem, that people don't know that this is why the women are dying. They're not connecting the dots. Your thoughts?
It's always difficult to address criticism of underreporting because, you know, obviously, as somebody once famously said, you don't know what you don't know. But it's unlikely, given the high profile of this medication, every place that it's being used, that there could be any significant number of deaths that are going unreported. Now, I could well acknowledge, given the cryptic nature of these infections and these deaths, that there could have been women dying of apparent infection where the diagnosis of the specific organism, Clostridium sordellii, has not been made. But it's very difficult to imagine that there have been significant number of deaths due to this that are going unreported, regardless of the cause. You have to realize that this has been used throughout Western Europe for almost a decade now, which has very excellent medical care, excellent public health reporting systems, excellent supervision of their drug supply, much like we have from the FDA in the United States. It's hard to imagine that there are a lot of deaths going unreported, although I could acknowledge that if there were some deaths, they might not recognize that they were due to this specific organism.
And what should be done now? You've come to some conclusions in an editorial in today's New England Journal of Medicine after a lot of research into this. What should happen with this drug, Dr. Green?
Well, I think it's important to keep this whole issue in some sense of perspective, and it's very easy to lose your sense of perspective under the circumstances. First of all, anything that has to do with reproduction, anything that has to do with abortion in the United States is always highly charged, both emotionally and politically, and it's very easy to lose sight of the facts involved in all of these cases. And certainly neither I nor anyone else wants to minimize or dismiss the tragedy of the deaths of these five women. All of these women were young, healthy women. None of them appeared to have any risk factors for bad things happening to them during the course of a pregnancy termination with mifepristone. Nonetheless, obviously terrible things happened. So nobody wants to dismiss or minimize these tragic deaths. However, our best estimate is that this does occur in about 1 in 100,000 cases. 1 in 100,000 is a relatively small number of cases. I think it's terribly important that women who are going to have this procedure are aware of this, that medical care providers are aware of this potential, that this infection can present without fever. So it's very important to raise everybody's awareness of the potential for this devastating complication. But I think it would be an overreaction, given the available data, to just summarily withdraw the drug from the market. Mm.
Dr. Michael Green, Chief of Obstetrics at Massachusetts General Hospital here in Boston. He's written an editorial in today's issue of the New England Journal of Medicine about the risks associated with RU486. Dr. Green, thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
In this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, the science and ethics of face transplants. Do they work? Are they worth it? And after witnessing several friends die, a mountain climber questions whether the thrill is worth that risk. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now. The most dangerous job in the world? Well, it might belong to a Chinese coal miner. Each year, more than 5,000 miners die in China, and the latest accident last Sunday killed more than 160. Critics blame corruption and poor safety standards for the high death rate in China, which accounts for 35% of world coal production, but 80% of fatalities. Well, the majority of the coal mined around the world today is burned to generate electricity. But here in the U.S., there's also growing consumer demand for coal as a cheaper alternative to oil and natural gas to heat homes. You might remember we spoke recently with the owner of an energy supply in the Boston area who's selling so much coal that he took his employees to visit coal mines in Pennsylvania as a sort of refresher course for those who'd never seen the stuff in the ground. But some in Pennsylvania are concerned about renewed use of coal by consumers. Bruce Golden is with an organization called the Western Pennsylvania Coalition for Abandoned Mine Reclamation. And Bruce, the website for the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection says modern mining methods have improved safety here in the U.S., and modern laws require that coal mining can't even begin if it will result in environmental harm. So what is your concern about coal mining?
My main concern is the coal mining is a past. Prior to 1977, when there were not sufficient laws, coal mining was done in a very environmentally unsound way. And as a result of that, we're still living with problems that had been created, let's say, as much as 150 years ago to this very day. Those problems are mine-scarred lands and water pollution.
Well, in fact, and looking at your website, we see terms like yellow boy, honey pile, red dog. And I guess if you grew up there in Pennsylvania, you know what those mean, but tell us who didn't.
All of those terms refer to waste materials from coal mining. Yellow boy, for anybody who has traveled through Pennsylvania or any other coal mining state, or even mining for that matter, and you've seen an orange stream, you have seen yellow boy. It's a rust-like compound, which is the pollution that's produced in mines that haven't been mined in an environmentally sensitive way.
And a lot of these mines have been abandoned, and so this drainage from these mines goes into these stream beds. What is it? What is in it that makes these stream beds orange?
It's this rust-like compound. It's an iron oxide, actually, that is that the orange color. And that's very bad for the stream and the life in it. What it will do is coat the bottom of the stream, and any of the bugs that live there will be smothered, and it doesn't leave anything for the fish to eat.
In fact, how many of Pennsylvania's streams and rivers have been killed because of abandoned mines?
This is Pennsylvania's biggest water pollution problem. Over 4,000 miles of streams have been impaired by abandoned mine drainage.
You said that this is a problem that can't be solved in your lifetime or in your kids' lifetimes. Pretty dire thought, but can it be solved at all?
Oh, it certainly can. It's a matter of bringing to bear enough resources to the problem, and that is where the problem is. We just don't have enough resources to do it.
Well, what do you need to clean up these mines? What's called for?
Well, there are various types of technologies that are used. For example, if we're talking about water pollution, there are water treatment facilities that can be built. Lately, they are of the kind called passive treatment systems that use sort of nature's way of cleaning things up using constructed ponds of various designs. So that can help clean up the water pollution. As far as the land is concerned, well, then that's usually heavy construction that has to be applied there.
Again, going back to the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection website, they say that the state has invested $20.7 million to construct 13 acid mine drainage treatment plants around the state and to treat acid mine drainage discharges. You say, you know, a lot more resources and work needs to be done. What does it look like and feel like? I mean, when you look at this area, paint a picture for us.
It depends on what area you're looking at. There were two main types of mining that was done back in the old days. Well, and it still happens. There's deep mining or underground mining, and places where that's happened, what you normally see now are just the old mining communities that may be 100 years old. Along with that will be the associated buildings that once supported the mining. More and more, those buildings have been torn down, and it's not the same as it was. You'll sometimes also see open mine shafts, but again, that's something that's been cleaned up a lot. Mm. As far as surface mined or strip mining is concerned, where that hasn't been reclaimed, you'll see land that's just a mess. You'll see man-made cliffs. They're called high walls, where they've mined into the side of a hill, and they can be very dangerous. You'll see just piles of debris all over the place, and this land really can't be used for anything. It also has waste material all around it, and nothing likes to grow very well. So this land isn't really suitable for any productive use.
Well, in fact, you are working on a reclamation project right now. Can you tell us about that?
One of the reclamation projects we're working on now is actually dealing with the yellow boy that we were talking about earlier. It's actually a novel method that will extract that rust-like compound from the water, and as it turns out, that is actually a very good pigment. It's an orange pigment that can be used in paints. It's the proverbial getting lemonade from lemons.
Right, right. Well, Bruce Golden, again, with the Western Pennsylvania Coalition for Abandoned Coal Mine Reclamation. What do you think is going to happen now that people are clamoring for coal for home heating?
I don't like that idea so much because any time that you have these individual units that are burning coal, coal is a very dirty fuel to burn. And if it's going to be burned, I think it has to be done in facilities, the high-tech facilities that can do it where you can really control the pollution. So I'm concerned about the smoky air pollution that is produced here.
Even though there are all sorts of environmental laws that have been passed in the last 100 years to try to get rid of that problem.
That's normally not the case on a very small scale. Like individual homeowners are normally given a waiver for doing that, and it's still not uncommon in my part of the world to see older homes with this sort of yellow smoke coming from the chimneys. And it's a sure sign that they're burning coal.
And Bruce, I mentioned at the top, we spoke with an energy supplier who took his salespeople to a Pennsylvania mine to remind them of what, you know, coal is all about because they're selling so much of it here in the Boston area. It sounds as if maybe he ought to have also gone to an abandoned mine.
It's an eye-opener, for sure. But because there was so much mining that took place here in Pennsylvania, it's something that we have to live with all the time. And unfortunately, it's also one of those problems that sort of has melded into the background. So people don't always see it.
Bruce Golden again with the Western Pennsylvania Coalition for Abandoned Coal Mine Reclamation. Bruce, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Robin.
Okay, and don't forget, still to come, the music of New Orleans. New CDs featuring the sounds of the Crescent City and benefiting the victims of Katrina. You don't want to miss this. You're listening to Here and Now. A bizarre new crime spree in the city of Baltimore is leaving police and everyone else in the dark. Thieves have somehow managed to cut down and make off with more than 130 city light poles, sometimes stealing them in broad daylight. The 30-foot aluminum poles cost the city about $750 a piece, and thieves can sell them to scrap metal yards for about 30 to 35 cents a pound, or about $85 a pole. Joining us on the line is Baltimore Sun columnist Kevin Cowherd. Kevin, how are these guys doing this? These poles, to start, are 250 pounds, and you list other hardships they must be encountering.
Yeah, well, that's the whole question, Robin. How are they doing it? It's very organized, obviously. It appears to be people sort of impersonating utility crews.
Well, they put out cones, right? They put out orange cones sometimes?
Yeah, they're cones out. They're apparently pulling up in utility vans. And they're, you know, for all intents and purposes, they look like a normal utility crew. And they're doing it on busy roads, and they're doing it on roads that aren't so busy, so there's really no pattern to where they've struck.
Well, and they're doing it well and quickly, and as you write, you know, how are they doing it without frying themselves on the wiring or having the pole topple?
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's one of the mysteries, although recently police have begun to theorize that they're sort of cutting the pole and just letting the pole topple off to the side of the road.
Oh,
so,
goodness.
You know, I guess, you know, apparently they're not blocking any highways, let's put it that way.
Well, and police are also saying that they're probably being sold for scrap metal.
Correct.
By who? Do they have an idea?
No, you know, they could be junkies, to be honest with you. Baltimore's got a real problem with lots of heroin addicts and lots of other addicts, and there's talk that it could be someone involved in the drug trade. But on the other hand, this is a pretty sophisticated operation, and it just might be some people that are, you know, doing some kind of a guerrilla operation for scrap metal.
Well, this story comes as a report that uses FBI crime data rates Baltimore as the sixth most dangerous city in America overall and the second most dangerous city of its size, just behind Detroit. So it would seem as if pole thefts are the least of the problems right now. But how are people in Baltimore reacting to this?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, it's such a puzzling story that people are really, they're having fun with this, believe it or not. It's not as grim as some of the other things that have happened in this town, the murder rates and the drug addiction rates and everything. So it's puzzling the police. It's puzzling the transportation officials. But I think the average citizen is just, you know, just can't believe that people are stealing light poles. I mean, what's next? Are they, you know, they're going to start stealing buildings?
Well, in fact, Baltimore has been trying to come up with a plan to rebrand the city, spending $500,000 to come up with a new slogan. Your suggestions were pretty cool. Baltimore, is it me or is it dark around here? What are some of the others?
Well, I mean, to me, you know, right away, Baltimore, who's stealing our light poles is one that you know, I mean, to me, that's the major mystery. Or how about Baltimore, you save energy your way, we'll save energy ours. It's another one that I put out there, or Baltimore leading the fight against light pollution.
Right. First in the nation.
Yeah, and people are, again, they're having fun with this to a degree, but believe me, the police want to get to the bottom of it because it's so expensive to replace these poles.
Well, speaking of that, can't they just go to the scrap yards and wait for somebody to come in with poles?
Well, it's exactly what they're doing. They're staking out all these scrap metal yards down here, but so far they haven't found anything that no one has turned in any scrap metal that looks like it came from these aluminum poles. So it's a huge mystery, and the cops say they're still working on it.
Well, we understand we're getting back to how to, you know, address the city's rebranding issue. One reader of your paper had an idea. Fred Shokin of Baltimore reminded readers that the city is where Francis Scott Key wrote the Star-Spangled Banner during the British bombing of Baltimore in the War of 1812. And Fred wrote a logo with the words Baltimore, home of the brave, and images of the waterfront, a sailing ship, a 15-star, 15-stripe flag, fireworks, would link Baltimore to history, patriotism. And as he writes, that wasn't hard, and it didn't cost $500,000.
Exactly. Well, you know, I think they're going for a little lighter touch than that. It's a marketing slogan that they're after, a little more than just drawing attention to Baltimore. So I'm not sure that one would actually work for them.
Kevin Cowherd, columnist for the Baltimore Sun. He spoke to us about this exodus of light poles from the city streets there, a serious problem. We're having some fun with it. But Kevin, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
It's raining in Baltimore, baby, but everything else is the same.
And now. And that's Canal Street Blues by clarinetist Dr. Michael White, a cut from one of several new CD anthologies released to benefit victims of Hurricane Katrina. These CDs celebrate the various musical forms that New Orleans and the Gulf Coast have given the world, from jazz, blues, and funk to R&B, Zydeco, and the high-spirited second-line sound of the Mardi Gras Indians. And these discs also benefit various charities helping the victims of the storm. Here now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs is here to tell us more. Welcome back, James.
Hello, Robin.
And let's start with the first one, because I know some jazz purists, you know, will raise their eyebrows at the idea that Starbucks is involved in the first one you're going to tell us about.
Well, it's a bracing kind of music for a place that sells bracing beverages, I suppose,
right.
Starbucks. Right now we're going to turn to an anthology whose title is I Believe to My Soul, and this one is a little bit different from the others that we'll feature today.
How so?
Well, for one thing, it spotlights nothing but vocalists and instrumentalists who are known for their first-rate work in soul music. There are only five artists featured, and not all of them are from New Orleans. You've got Irma Thomas, the queen of New Orleans soul, mm-hmm. and Alan Toussaint, the eminent keyboardist, singer, songwriter, record producer. These are major figures in New Orleans rhythm and blues. But also on board are Mavis Staples, Memphis soul queen Ann Peebles, and Billy Preston, who's had a long and varied career in both soul and rock and roll. I Believe to My Soul was produced by a guy named Joe Henry, who at the moment is the hottest producer in today's retro soul movement.
What should we hear?
Well, we're going to hear one of four selections done by Alan Toussaint. This is a song he wrote called Mi Amor, My Love, and it's got that punchy horn sound associated with the Crescent City. At age 67, Toussaint has become a smoother vocalist, at least in my opinion. Let's listen to Alan Toussaint.
Honey, you mean so much to my life, and so much to my world, and most of all, so much to my heart, oh. Much like a precious stone, a seal of perfection, what I feel is what is there.
Toussaint on the new CD, I Believe to My Soul. And by the way, at our website, here-now.org, we'll have all the information about all the CDs. And James, I know you also want to tell us about this None Such set, Our New Orleans 2005. We heard a little taste of it at the beginning.
The roster includes such eminent New Orleanians as Dr. John, the aforementioned Irma Thomas, Alan Toussaint, but you've also got, from the world of singer-songwriters, James Taylor and Randy Newman. The track I have selected is by the Mardi Gras Indian tribe called the Wild Magnolias, led by Big Chief Bo Dallas. The Mardi Gras Indian tribes are known for their brightly colorful satin costumes, and you've also got that surging second-line rhythm as the Mardi Gras Indians strut down New Orleans streets during Mardi Gras time.
Now, I'm going to stop you there because you have hit this out for us before. What's the second-line rhythm?
The second-line rhythm pertains to the brass bands that would play following a New Orleans funeral. The second line would be the mourners twirling their umbrellas and setting up their own rhythm. And translated to music, there's the heartbeat of the bass drum, and over it, you've got a snare drum beat that functions kind of like the spokes of a wheel going round and round. It's just a constant circle.
So let's hear some of it. What song shall we listen to?
Well, we're going to hear the Mardi Gras Indian staple. It's a street chant called Brother John is Gone, and that segues into Herc Jolly John. And just listen to the propulsive drums behind Bo Dallas and the Wild Magnolias. This is fantastic stuff.
Herc Jolly John, Mardi Gras.
It makes you want to move your feet. But we've got to move along because we have another CD to listen to. This
we
is
do.
From Blue Note?
Yeah, we're going to change the mood entirely now as we turn to a set on the Blue Note label called Higher Ground Hurricane Relief Benefit Concert. Wynton Marsalis, who performs on a number of tracks, leads the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. He also wrote the liner notes, and he was a key figure in organizing the project. But again, the music is wide-ranging. We go from Bette Midler, James Taylor, Diana Krall, and gospel great Shirley Caesar to Art and Aaron Neville, and some of the finest of New Orleans contemporary jazz players like Irvin Mayfield, trumpeter, and the Jordan family, and Wynton Marsalis.
I know you've picked a moving number by another artist, Cassandra Wilson.
I have, and this is Duke Ellington's Come Sunday from his suite Black, Brown, and Beige. It's a prayer set to a tone poem, I guess one could call it that. Here's the plangent voice of Cassandra Wilson. Again, it's from the album Higher Ground, Come Sunday.
Go to him in secret, he will hear your every prayer. Up from dawn till sunset, men work hard all day. Come Sunday, oh, come Sunday, that's the day.
Ah, sublime.
Truly and deeply beautiful.
Yep. Well, how do you top that? Apparently, you do have another selection, and this isn't from the benefit CDs we've been speaking
of. No, it's not.
But it is in the genre of New Orleans music.
Well, it features all New Orleans musicians. Well, let me amend that. It features musicians who are either from New Orleans or spent significant time there. The leader is the drummer and composer Herlin Riley, who's best known for his work with Wynton Marsalis and with the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. The album's title is Cream of the Crescent, New Orleans being the Crescent City. I think this is one of the very best jazz albums of 2005. Herlin Riley wrote all but one of the 9 tunes on the disc, and his compositions are well-organized, fully realized. The Riley original that we're going to hear is called Prophet Stop, and it grooves irresistibly. Listen during the ensemble to Herlin Riley's nifty brushwork. The art of brushes is becoming a lost one. And then there's this little duo unison section between Marsalis's trumpet and Victor Goines's clarinet. Also, the total spirit of this band, fantastic. The Herlin Riley Sextet, Prophet Stop.
James, I know that there are a couple of other Katrina benefit CDs you just want to mention. Again, we'll have this all on the website, but for those at home taking notes.
Very quickly, Robin, there's Dr. John and the Lower 911. The album's called Cipiana Hurricane. It's all new music. It's also on the Blue Note label. And from Rounder Records, a first-class collection of previously recorded jazz, funk, soul, Mardi Gras Indian stuff. It's called A Celebration of New Orleans Music, and it includes everyone from Jelly Roll Morton and the ubiquitous Irma Thomas to Professor Longhair, Harry Connick Jr., and Branford Marsalis. This is first-class material.
And we were reminded in listening to you over the last few minutes just how much sounds came from this devastated area. So again, for further details on the music we heard today and the Hurricane Katrina relief causes, some of these CDs will benefit. Go to our website, here-now.org. James Isaacs, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin. See you soon. Go out and buy some of these albums benefiting nothing but great causes.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin.